From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. International journalism and freedom of the press. Those are the topics this week on Soundings, the first of two programs on international themes. My guests are Peter Bird Martin, editor-in-chief of the South North News Service, and Mark Bench of Bonneville Broadcasting International. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about multi-ethnic societies. In 1987, approximately 70% of the world's nations have presses subject to some form of government control or censorship. Yet even in many nations that enjoy freedom of the press, there is a noteworthy degree of misunderstanding about the politics and cultures of other societies. Mark Bench from Bonneville Broadcasting and Peter Martin from the South North News Service. Let's talk about international journalism from the standpoint of the United Nations and UNESCO. Big flap about licensing journalists, in other words, keeping the journalist under the thumb, as it were, of the local governments. What is all the fuss here, Peter?
I think we ought to start with, again, I'm not going to make the case of the other side, but I think we better acknowledge what this grows out of. What this grows out of is the fact that poor nations are very poor, that they can't afford a press as we know it, let alone a free press, because there's not much money there, there's not much training there, there's not much experience there, and so when a country gets into that kind of fix, it looks to the government to try to do something about it. And so in this situation, what has happened is that those governments have decided they have to set up government-run presses, government-run newspapers, government-run broadcasting, and government-run feeds of national news to an international network. You go to and you need money to do this. You need money for training, you need money for equipment, you need money to buy the presses, you need money for newsprint. It costs money. Your country doesn't have money. It doesn't have a free enterprise society to support a competitive press that will compete and earn money. And so to start running, what you want to do is set up a government-owned press with somebody else's money. Now, where do you get this money? Well, these days you go to the United Nations. And where do you go to the United Nations to get money for a press? You go to several organizations. You go to United Nations Development Program, because we're talking about development. You go also for supplemental money to the United Nations Fund for Population Activities, because they are interested in population measures, and your government is going to be reporting this thing. But mainly, you go to the organization that seems to be most concerned with cultural affairs.
And that's UNESCO.
And it's auxiliary IPDC, which is International Program for the Development of Communications.
All right. Now, this is Mark Bench talking right then. Let's really be innocent about this. What's wrong with that? If I'm trying to develop my country and I'm trying to do the best job that I can, and here you big-shot Americans come and tell me that I'm all wrong, that I ought to let just anybody wander in and write whatever they want. Attack and defend for me. Mark Bench?
One of the problems there, of course, is that when indeed, let's say, for example, that a lot of money comes in for this source, and the government chap who's in charge of that pockets it.
So we have the problem of corruption.
So there is corruption, and of course, if there indeed, say there's bona fide corruption, I mean, it's going on. Their people need to know about it. Will they ever know about it? Of course not.
Is this widespread, just parenthetically? What would be your estimate?
Unfortunately, it's difficult to tell because it'll never get, because frankly, it does not get reported.
The rock hasn't been turned over.
Right. Because the government, really quickly, excuse me, the government then, if it began to be reported, the government would squeeze the sources of information. They could tax newsprint very heavily, or they could cut off the power to a radio transmitter, or confiscate a crystal so that no broadcasting can be done. I mean, there are all kinds of repressive forces that they can bring to bear.
Peter Martin, what should we do about this? How should take it upon yourself to speak for your fellow countrymen and women? How should we respond?
what we have to respond with is a couple of centuries of time.
Mm-hmm. That is to say, a journalistic tradition.
It has to grow up. The thing is that you have a situation in Britain where the BBC operates. It is a government arm. It is funded by government in the fact that it receives taxes that are collected by the government for its maintenance and operation. And in Canada, we have a similar situation with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And those two organizations, the BBC and the CBC, managed to maintain their independence pretty darned well.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they have a long tradition.
And this is what you would be suggesting for these developing countries?
Eventually.
Uh-huh.
I don't see any other way to go at it except to go through the initial ringer of corruption, of government control, of propaganda. All of these things, there's not. I haven't said a nice word in the past four or five. And the fact that they are none of them nice words means that the human instinct is to do something about them, to rebel against them. What the South North News Service does by, and if I can be parochial for a minute, is to put a little burr under the national saddle of governments that are running their press. That burr is a person who begins to believe what a free press is and what it can do.
Mm-hmm.
We encourage him to write freely about what's going on in his country.
Let's just clarify one point very quickly here. There seems to be, maybe I am generalizing from my own impression, and therefore I'm being idiosyncratic, but there seems to be an impression that UNESCO is the real heavyweight in all of this, that it's a real sort of conspiratorial sensibility. Is that the case, Mark Bench?
I've been attending UNESCO meetings for 17 years, and was in the group that discovered the famous draft document of the Soviet Union regarding licensing and all these other areas. It was not then, and is not now, UNESCO's plot to close down free press.
So you would not abolish UNESCO?
Okay. No, I am speaking for myself, having worked within the organization as an NGO, a non-government organization, and having worked with them for a full 17 years, I'm here to tell you that much good is done by UNESCO. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that there are officials within UNESCO who I believe are tendentious, no question about it, who would disagree with everything I have to say, except that UNESCO is not all bad.
Mm-hmm.
I am not. I'm not in favor of our boycotting UNESCO. I think that there is corruption. I believe that there are financial reforms that must take place.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, do you disagree?
I do not disagree. No, I agree that UNESCO is doing a lot of good things. I think UNESCO is subject to whimsical management under the present administration, and I think that some small surgery in personnel could bring UNESCO around to doing the kind of work that it was designed to do in the first place.
Mark Bench, let me put it to you this way. In terms of international broadcasting, how much of the problem of propaganda or disinformation would seem to you to stem from, the old saw of Americans not understanding other cultures, that we simply don't know enough about Chile or Paraguay or Pakistan to pick up a story and be able intelligently to say to ourselves, there's something wrong here. You know, I shouldn't believe this, or I should question it. Is that the sort of thing that you grapple with on these commissions that you serve on? Tell me about this.
Sure. There is no question about the fact that Americans do not have sufficient information on foreign nationals.
All right. Now, is the burden there on the journalists or on the consumers?
Well, it's on the gatekeeper.
Uh-huh. That is to say, the journalists.
There's no question about it. If you could go to a UPI clicker, I call it, the machine, or an AP or Reuters or any of them, and look at the information that comes across, you will find that there is ample information there coming across on Third World. I mean, by leaps and bounds, gobs of information.
But the news hole dictates that only so much of this is going to get
The news hole dictates what is going to be there, and then because their marketing tests say that people are not particularly interested in this subject, they're not going to buy the newspaper with headlines that talk about developmental journalism.
Uh-huh. Peter Martin?
Yeah, and I think we can go beyond that a little bit. I think those gatekeepers, those editors, the people who decide what goes in the paper and what does not go in the paper, they're not well trained enough.
That's true.
They don't understand other societies. They haven't had a chance to travel, to immerse themselves in other cultures, to learn almost instinctively what's disinformation and what's mm-hmm. information, mm-hmm. what's true and what's false, what's probable and what's improbable. And also, that an editor tends to be an arrogant cuss.
Yeah.
We all edit for ourselves. We maybe edit for a hypothetical reader, but the thing is that if we're good editors, we decide that what interests us is going to interest our readers. And we need to broaden our own interests. I think there should be better training, better programs to send editors who are going to decide this thing mm-hmm. overseas so they can learn something for themselves.
Let's talk about journalism's naysayers. Apropos of what Peter Martin has just pointed out here, the idea of journalism policing itself. Is this a problem, or is this a challenge, as it were, on the international broadcasting scene?
It's highly controversial.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, you go to a Latin American country and tell them that they should be self-policing. What it means is self-censorship. Mm-hmm. We would, in many Latin American countries, we would prefer truly to be censored rather than to be self-censored, mm-hmm. because then you give out weak articles. I'd rather have someone say to me, "No, you may not write that," than or you may not broadcast
rather
that,
than a watered
rather
down.
Than to get a watered down version.
Uh-huh. Peter Martin.
I disagree there. I think that the editor,
any information is better than no information.
I believe that wholeheartedly. Uh-huh. And beyond that, I believe that yes, there should be such a thing as good, responsible, factual, as near objective information as possible.
Mark Bench from Bonneville Broadcasting and Peter Martin from the South North News Service. Apropos of what you have just been talking about here, the quotient of junk in the press and I suppose on the airwaves, in a way that what crosses my mind now is the consumer, which is to say the listener and the reader. Do you think that people trust the press internationally? Do you think that, again, as I said earlier, are we putting the burden on the consumer in a fashion that it doesn't belong there, that it should be, as Mark Bench says, on the gatekeeper himself? Let's take it one thing at a time. What about this question of trust? Mark, what do you think?
Having been in the shortwave business as well as in the radio and television business, I understand that trust is very important. I can tell you that the press is, at the moment, not very well trusted.
Uh-huh. Have you got any specifics for me there?
Well, I believe the press is presently rated just slightly above Congress in trust, uh-huh. but it's barely. I think we're talking in micro inches. And I think that that's an enormous shame.
How did this happen? Is it possible for one or both of you to talk in what historical terms? How did we get to the point where people don't trust the press, national or international, to the degree that that we should or ought to?
Well, the Walter Cronkites were very well trusted.
Mm-hmm. But now we're talking about personalities there, or are we? Are we talking about more than that, Peter?
In broadcasting, it is personalities. Uh-huh. You're talking about people, and they have bylines in
uh-huh.
print.
Uh-huh. Peter Martin?
I think that it is natural for the press not to be trusted. We are entrusted by the Constitution to upset apple carts.
In other words, in the same way that you journalists don't want to trust the politicians, the public should have a healthy skepticism about the press.
They should read selectively.
Isn't that going to hurt your feelings?
It doesn't hurt my feelings, because if in my original proposition here that let 1,000 pieces of junk bloom, mm-hmm. Sooner or later, the junk will die off, because uh-huh. too much junk just actually kills itself.
Except in England.
But look at the situation in the past few years. There's plenty of reason to distrust the press, because the public has made up their mind that Spiro Agnew, for instance, should be elected vice president of the United States, or the public decided in their minds that Richard Nixon should be elected president of the United States. And the press, doing its natural thing, probing around, poking around, looking at things that smelled bad and sounded suspicious, mm-hmm. have told the public that their judgment's not very good, mm-hmm. That they made a mistake. And then they went after it and after it. And, of course, the press being the press, when they get onto a good thing, they go with it. They keep beating it into people's heads. Boy, did you people goof this time.
Right.
Look at this clinker you elected president. After a while, you say, okay, enough. But the thing is, the press doesn't let up. And after a while, you start distrusting the press because they have been so unsettling to you.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about international journalism and freedom of the press, the first of two Soundings programs on international themes. My guests are Peter Bird Martin, editor-in-chief of the South North News Service, and Mark Bench of Bonneville Broadcasting International. Among the pitfalls of international journalism are disinformation, the question of licensing of journalists, journalism engaged in ideological causes, and the homogenization of international journalism. How is the world press responding to these issues, and with what results? What do you make of a term like PAC journalism on the international scene? Is that the case on the international airwaves? Mark Bench, I would guess that it wouldn't be the case because of all the ethnic and cultural differences that exist internationally. Peter Martin began by talking about the sort of homogeneity of the American press. Tell me about this.
Well, there is a certain PAC-ness among the third world areas regarding, as we called before, development broadcasting.
Does this mean what? Anti-Americanism?
Oh, no.
Is that the core of it?
No. It is their concern, however, that America is not covering them well. I would not consider it. I would not call it anti-Americanism, but I would call it anti-American journalism coverage of their countries. And there is a general feeling throughout Third World on that, and I would call that, if you would like to call that PAC journalism, you may.
Mm-hmm. Peter?
Yeah, that's true, and it reflects the same thing that I just was talking about as far as the U.S. press covering U.S. politics. The things that attract the attention of the international journalist, the journalist from the North who descends on the South to cover an event, is a coup or a crisis or corruption or catastrophe or a personality story. The Western journalists who go to countries in the Third World carry with them the desires of their editors to have interesting stories in the paper. And the interesting stories are stories about incredible corruption. Mrs. Marcos's 3,000 pairs of shoes.
Right.
If there's anything that came out of the Philippines in the past 6 months that is going to stick in anybody's head, it's the number of shoes that woman had.
Well, now what you are addressing here is not so much the problem of corruption, not so much the problem of ideology or prejudice. You're at Buffett's here with the nature of news itself. It is what is novel. It is what is now. It is what is unusual. What are you going to do? Start publishing long cultural pieces in the newspaper and putting that sort of thing on the airwaves? Mark Bench?
That's exactly what the Third World would have us do.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done. That you can do a non-news story that is so interesting in it and of itself,
compelling,
right, that it'll be good reading. That's one of the things that the South North News Service is trying to do. We ask our writers, who are Third World people, to suggest at least once a month the most interesting thing they've heard of or know about that's happened in the past month.
And when you say interesting, you don't necessarily mean, quote, newsworthy. It doesn't have to be journalistic in the hard sense.
We mean interesting.
Yeah.
And they don't believe us, but then they will send us a short paragraph about something that happened in their village or something that happened in politics.
Uh-huh. Give us some examples, can
you? I'll give you the example I think we talked about earlier. We just got a story from Ghana, from a fishing village. Our correspondent there grew up in that fishing village, and he went back to the fishing village. And the thing that he heard about that interested him most was experience of fishermen who'd gone out 300 miles at sea in their canoes, and they catch tuna. Tuna is the good thing because you can feed a lot of people with tuna, and also you can sell the fish to other people. They brought back 5 tuna, and 3 of these tuna had red things growing out of their backs. They thought that these tuna were poisoned, bewitched, some evil spirit had touched the tuna, and so they wanted to be sure that the tuna was good to eat and good to sell. So they called in the witch doctor in the village, and the witch doctor then went through a series of incantations to determine what had happened here. It involved pouring palm oil on the ground and doing certain chants and wails, and killing a chicken. And if the chicken died with its feet up in the air, it was bad tuna. And if the chicken died with its feet on the ground, it was good tuna. And three times the chicken died with its feet in the air, and it looked as though this tuna was going to have to be thrown away and could not be demystified. Along came the town drunk. At the end of this thing, the town drunk was a ne'er-do-well. He had been off to Accra. He'd learned to read and write at a mission school, but he'd also learned in the big city to drink a lot, and he came back, and so nobody paid much attention to him, and he wandered around town, and he got handouts and stuff, but he came down to the beach and looked at these fish. He picked up one of these red things that was sticking out of the back of the tuna, and he read on the back, "International Tuna Tracking Project." and an address, and it said, if you catch this tuna, in effect, send this marker back to the International Tuna Tracking Project, something or other address, Madrid, Spain, and a reward will be sent to you. He read this thing aloud to the people. They were dumbfounded. At first, they didn't believe him, but joy spread, and they sent the thing off. They all got T-shirts, I understand.
What does this teach us about international broadcasting and journalism?
I think it teaches us that that's a good story.
Yes, it is.
It's a story that tells you a little bit about how people live in Ghana, how they earn their living, what their belief systems are all about, what constitutes good and bad with them, what can happen to the overeducated kid. It tells you an awful lot about life in the third world. I think it even could be development journalism, because it shows the impact of a development project, the tuna tracking, on the third world.
Why don't we have this stuff on our airwaves, and why don't we have it in our newspapers? A very large question. Mark Bench?
It don't test good.
You mean the demographers, is that right?
I'm saying that fortunately or unfortunately, we are told as broadcasters and as newspaper editors, we are told what our market is, and our market is adults 25 to 54. And then so we go to adults 25 to 54 and we say to them, what are you interested in? Here's the menu. And it's much easier to do marketing surveys this way, multiple choice, and nothing is on there about tuna fish with red markers on their backs.
All right, now this is the problem of agenda setting. Do I have this right, Peter?
You have it right. I think the broadcast business is probably a little bit more immediately subject to this kind of market survey journalism than the press is. We have 12 subscribing newspapers to our organization. If 10 of them don't use this story, I'll be very much surprised, because it's a good yarn.
Let us know. It is a good one.
Yeah, and I think it's the kind of thing where somebody would say, I want my readers to like my newspaper. They're going to get enough about Marcos. They're going to get enough about the IMF and how people aren't paying their debts. Let's let them up a little bit this today, and we'll give them this good yarn about these fisher people in Ghana. So I think here it's a gatekeeper problem. I'm a gatekeeper. It's up to me to decide what stories we send out to our subscribing newspapers. It's up to them to decide whether they want this stuff enough to keep subscribing to my news service.
And if it comes with a photograph, it would be much better.
Yeah,
absolutely.
From the standpoint, again, of the consumer of journalism, print and electronic, on the international scene, what would you do to move things along? Mark?
I'd like to tell a brief story. I was at a meeting of the World Press Freedom Committee many years ago when a UPI official, a high UPI official, United Press International official, was talking about how they were having difficulty finding having difficulty finding people who could cover a country well. But particularly there were complaints from the country that they could not find an American who could cover their country well. And the government said, look, let us, the foreign government said, let us suggest to you some people whom you could hire who would know the background of our country, know what kinds of problems we're having, and be able to put things into perspective. And he said, fine, go ahead, recommend someone. We'd like to hear whom you could recommend. The name the government recommended was the recent propaganda minister of the country.
Is that necessarily a bad thing? I mean, the tone of your voice suggests we wouldn't touch this guy no matter what.
They didn't. They didn't. Yes.
It is necessarily a bad thing. That person has not been doesn't understand the needs of the free press back in the United States. There is a serious problem here of unfamiliarity and lack of trust. Now, it's hard enough for us to train U.S. journalists to be good international journalists. The people who really understand local societies well and thoroughly and fully are people who grew up in those societies, citizens of the countries. And as Mark points out, why not use those people?
So what you want is a sort of international provincialism. You want people who know these their own back doorsteps very well, and yet can address an international audience in such a fashion that that backstep makes some sense. Mark Bench from Bonneville Broadcasting and Peter Martin from the South North News Service. Let's conclude our conversation. What would you tell a general audience about international journalism? What is it that you think is its primary strengths and weaknesses? Give me your reflections there. Peter, let me begin with you.
The best thing about international journalism is that it's about international people. Mm-hmm. The strength is that those people have fascinating stories, have lives that are interesting to hear about, get into trouble, that the smart guy gets his comeuppance, that the dumb guy gets taken, that there are so many common experiences that we all understand and are interested in, that international journalism has a tremendous capacity to bridge understanding gaps by demonstrating that what's fascinating about one society can be understood and be fascinating in another society.
Cultural differences notwithstanding, we don't need these artificial barriers. Mark Bench?
I would say that the strengths are the fact that it really does or can make the world a smaller place. Mm-hmm. It can prove that we are indeed neighbors and that we all put our trousers on, some of us who wear trousers, others sarongs and so forth, but the world is indeed a smaller place and that we are all brothers and sisters. And rather than to talk about weaknesses, I'd like to talk about needs. Uh-huh. And I think that there is in international broadcasting, again, a need for understanding and a need for journalists to understand the problems of the developing countries and for the developing countries to understand the enormous need, how it benefits them to allow truth to be told about their countries.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about international journalism and freedom of the press. My guests were Peter Bird Martin, Editor-in-Chief of the South North News Service, and Mark Bench of Bonneville Broadcasting International. For a cassette copy of Soundings on International Journalism, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about international politics and multi-ethnic societies. My guests will be Hedva Ben Israel and Emmanuel Gutman of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about international journalism. At issue are questions about disinformation, the licensing of journalists, and journalism enlisted in ideological causes. Some answers and insights from Peter Martin of the South North News Service and Mark Bench of Bonneville Broadcasting International. Freedom of the Press and International Journalism, the topics this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.